Well, members, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. I'm aware that maybe some folks didn't remember that we were starting a half hour earlier today, but we've got quite a bit on the docket, and we can start without quorum unofficially. And I think we might do that. We can start by, we have a new Republican research person who wants to introduce yourself to the committee so we all know who you are.
Madam Chair, my name is Danny Mazzillo, and I just started today for GOP research.
Welcome. Welcome to the committee, Dan. Okay, so what we have on the agenda for today is to hear basically from the folks who've been doing a lot of the work on the ground, a lot of the advocates for all the issues of housing, and I'm grateful that they have come here today. We're going to be hearing from Minnesota Housing Partnership, the Coalition for the Homeless, from Homeline Legal Services Advocacy Project, Greater Minnesota Housing, some folks from St. Paul, Planning and Economic Development. Then we're going to also hear some specific issues around housing related to victims of sex trafficking, and also an invitation to us to perhaps be involved in a program where we can experience some of the issues that are happening to folks out there who do not have affordable housing from the Day in the Life program. So that's what we're going to go through today, and actually we'll start without a quorum present, and I guess we'll start with you, Chip, if you want to just introduce yourself and help us learn about the trends in Minnesota housing.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chip Halbach, the Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership, and the Housing Partnership is a nonprofit organization that does two things. One is that we provide technical assistance and small grants and loans to help communities and nonprofit agencies plan and develop affordable housing. Most of that work is focused in Greater Minnesota. Then we also provide various research functions and public policy advocacy here at the state level and on national housing issues to help promote housing affordability across Minnesota and the country. And I was asked today to provide an overview of some basic trends related to housing affordability. My presentation will not get into the housing industry as a whole, but focus on the things we follow in order to determine if the state's residents are advancing or falling further behind in their ability to pay for housing. And this trend report is something that we have available on our website in much more detail than I'm going to go into today. And it's updated on an annual basis when the new American Community Survey data comes out, which is in the fall of each year. We update our work here so that we show what's happening on a year-to-year basis. In addition to the statewide data that I'm going to get into today, we also have individual sets of housing trends for four major metro areas in the state, the Twin Cities, of course, and then Duluth, Rochester, and St. Cloud. So any of the information I'm showing here is also available for those individual jurisdictions. And I should say also, because of what's happening in our economy and the budget, that we're missing some of the critical detail in our annual report. So you'll see a couple of slides at the end of this presentation that intend to capture the more recent change of what's going on with housing affordability. And later this winter or early spring, we'll have a report that also provides a more frequent updates on some of the critical housing issues facing the state and lower income people in the state. So with that, and you have handouts of the slides too. So for the first slide, which is the percentage of the state's households that are paying over half of their income for housing, we consider that to be really the key indicator of stress in the state, because if you are paying more than half of your gross income for housing, you are likely cutting back on other essential family and household expenses like purchase of food, health care, and daycare, and other things that are really critically important to family life. But if you're paying that much of your income for housing, then you have to be cutting back on those other expenditures, or you just can't make it. So what we're showing here is a leveling off, but of the proportion of the state's population paying over half their income for housing. But you see between 2002 and 2006 that there was a fairly steady rise, so that at this point in time, there's now just about 1 in 8 households across the state is paying over half of its income for housing. So that, again, is a very troublesome statistic, and one that I hope the committee gets into more during the course of this legislative session. And here we have how that's broken down, and you can see that while there's been this divide between renters and ownership, and while there's been a steady climb in renters paying over half their income for housing, there was, starting in 2004, when we had the run-up in housing prices and all of the crummy mortgages around, you see a very much of a jump-up in ownership households paying over half their income for housing. And so you could see also then, it's, for renters, it's somewhat north of 100,000 households across the state paying over half their income for housing, and for homeowners it's increased to 140,000. This slide puts Minnesota in the context of other states that have seen rapid increases in the percentage or share of their households paying over half their income for housing. And the point of the slide is to show that Minnesota has increased more rapidly than other states. And we started from a relatively low base of back in 2000, of about 6% of the households paying over half their income from housing. But then that steadily increased to, at the end of 2007, it was 12.3%. And increase between those 2 years, that's significantly faster growth than any of the other states in the nation. Although, as you see, our 12.3% is still below that of many other states, but it puts us more of in the middle of the pack of something that, again, across this country, we have hundreds of thousands and millions of, here in Minnesota, and millions of families across the country paying over half their income for housing in this tenuous position.
Chair? Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to the graph that you've got here, I think you're looking at 6.5% in 12, mm-hmm. but you're looking at about a 6% difference, and that seems to be pretty uniform throughout all the states that you've got represented up there. So how can you, you know, you're saying that it is disproportionately large because we started with a small percentage. However, the percentage remains the same, pretty uniform throughout all of those that you've got demonstrated up there. I'm wondering if you can explain that a little bit.
Well, if you look at the second state, New Hampshire there, that it really is similar to Minnesota in that back in 2000 it had a fairly low base, 8% of its population paying over half their income for housing, and it jumped up to 13.9%. So it grew significantly, just not as much as Minnesota. So you have in all of these states that are fast growing in terms of percentage of their households paying over half their income for housing, you would say that Minnesota is similar to New Hampshire, Delaware, Wisconsin, Virginia, and close to Maryland are states that had a fairly low base and then increased to a level that's somewhat similar to the level we increased to. Whereas some of the other states had significant increases, but they started at a higher amount.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I guess the question I would have on that is, are any of these other states have as an aggressive housing policy, affordable housing policy, as Minnesota?
Robert?
I would say of these states, I know Rhode Island has made a significant gain in the last 2 years to expand their resources for affordable housing. And then of all of these, Florida is the one that's really made the most significant investments in affordable housing, probably in the country. The other ones, I'm not sure. I know New Hampshire doesn't do much public expenditure for affordable housing. New Jersey does make a fairly significant investment. So I think it varies widely across these states.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next slide here shows increase. This compares for homeowners, income related to home prices, median income across the state for home prices, income related to median home prices, and then for renter, median renter income compared to median gross rent. And these just show that, again, there's been that prices for housing have significantly increased faster than income. And as we know, currently home prices are declining, but I would say that the declines, at least to date, have been nowhere near the amount of growth in price that happened from this period 2001 through 2007. So again, part of the reason we see homeowners and renters paying such high prices for housing is that the cost of the housing has increased much more significantly than income. And again, I mentioned earlier that we have the individual metro area statistics on a lot of our data, and of the four areas I mentioned, for rental housing anyway, Duluth and St. Cloud have the highest growth in rent compared to income.
Representative Scott, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious as to how vacancy rates corresponded with this.
We'll see a slide later on rental vacancy rates, so you can see that. And for owner vacancy rates, there's a later presentation on foreclosures and vacancies. It's still pretty low in home ownership, the vacancies. Rental is the one where there's been much more movement in terms of what the vacancy rates have been. But the vacancy rates have tightened for rental significantly over the last few years. Here we show, and this is just for 2007, is the income related to, before I was talking about the standard of paying over half your income for housing, which is severe distress. The typical and federal measure for what a household should be paying for housing in a very simple gross sense is 30% of your income for housing, because once you're above that, particularly if you're lower income, you again run into those critical trade-offs. So these two pie charts show for renters and homeowners is what income categories are paying over 30% of their income for housing. And you see for renters, it's mostly the households with, it's very low income households. For less than $20,000 is the majority of it, annual income. And then the second is the group that goes up to $35,000. For homeowners, it's much more evenly divided across the various income categories, and is what you might expect is people at higher incomes buy higher cost homes, and therefore set themselves up for paying higher percentages of their income for housing. This slide, which is somewhat complicated, so apologize for that, but again, it's looking at various job categories and what those job categories pay and the income that would be over a year's period, and then backing out at committing 30% of your income for housing, what you could afford. The upper line is that where the median, the income you would need for the medium priced home, and the lower line is the income you would need for the median price apartment. And the basics is that if you're a registered nurse, you have basically the income needed just from that job alone to pay for a median priced home. Whereas if at the other end of the income scale for a food worker, food prep worker, for instance, from that income alone, you do not have near the income needed for that median price apartment. And I think the main value of this type of data is to show that basically for all of these job categories, that they fairly well have tracked with the modest change in what the income needed to purchase a home or the income needed to rent an apartment. So it's not that jobs are being paid less than what's needed for these housing costs, but that household income, which takes into account job loss, working part-time, and all of those elements, is what is falling behind what is needed to pay for housing costs. And of course, now as the remaining slides here speak more of what's going on recently, and what's most important, because our state, as other states, are in this almost free fall, certainly an economic free fall in terms of what people's financial capacity and more importantly their basic confidence in the housing market. And as you see from this slide, it's just that the unemployment rate from Minnesota has tracked below the national unemployment rate until recently, when both are rapidly climbing. And that's going to have a big impact on housing from a couple of perspectives. One is a consumer perspective, which I'll get into in a minute, in terms of what you can pay for housing and the type of risk you want to take in purchasing housing, but also from an industry perspective, whereas I would say that the housing industry has suffered more in terms of unemployment than any other industry in the state. And Commissioner McElroy from Economic Development was in a recent presentation was saying that just in the building homes, that 16,000 jobs have been lost in the last couple of years, which is 28% of people employed in that line of work. And the overall loss in the housing industry runs tens of thousands more than those 16,000 construction jobs. Now, for the consumer, we'll look at three major areas. The first here is foreclosure, and again, there will be a presentation later today, which you'll get in much more detail. And this bar chart here breaks out what's going on in the different geographic areas. The gray is for the Twin Cities, and then in the narrow bands are Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester, and then the upper part of the bars is the rest of greater Minnesota. And I guess a couple of things with this. One is that in terms of numbers of foreclosures, it's really driven by what's going on in the Twin Cities. And as it says here, this is the 11 county Twin Cities area, so the broader Twin Cities area, which takes into account some of the outer ring counties where a lot of new development happened and a lot of foreclosure problems are going on. But the other thing I just point out is that looking at greater Minnesota, you might think that foreclosures would be concentrated in the large metro areas, but by this chart, it says that it's really the rest of greater Minnesota is the majority of foreclosures in that part of the state. The last couple of slides here. So this, and getting back to the earlier question, is what's going on with vacancy rates, and this runs from here in the metro area. We don't have the same quality of information for the remainder of the state. But for the metro area, we have the rental vacancies really from 2003 through the third quarter in 2008, declining rapidly, at least through the up till the last year, and kind of tapering off and actually trending up a tiny bit, but still significantly below what's called needed for the fluid working of the rental market. And in particular, apartments at the lower end of the income scale have these very tight vacancy rates. And in a report I mentioned before this committee in previous year, is one of the things that we've tracked is the number of apartments that are available statewide renting for $700 a month or below, which is affordable to the median income renter. And over the first half of this decade, the state lost about 1 in 5 of those apartments, so about 22%. So we see a loss of this lower income affordable rental stock, and at the same time, at least here, as the vacancy rates have tumbled, you see on the left that the average market rents have increased. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that we see a much more demand for these super scarce federal rent subsidies that we had in Minneapolis, for instance. Last year, they opened up the Section 8 list for the first time in a number of years, and you have over 14,000 households seek applications for those Section 8 certificates, and the Minneapolis Public Housing Agency only makes available some 30 apartments per month. So 14,000 going after 30 apartments per month. And different jurisdictions have seen similar demands for federal rent subsidies. So there's a tremendous demand for rent subsidies. And you'll have speakers later from Homeline who can get into more detail on that. They do an annual rent survey for the western part of the metro area. The other thing that we just think that we have to pay attention to what's happening in the immediate time frame is with homelessness. And we don't have good statewide data on this, but so this bar chart just shows the shelters that are being funded through Hennepin County programs, because we were able to readily access the trend line on that information. And you see that for a number of years, homelessness as indexed through people who are applying and using the shelters of Hennepin County was actually trending down a little bit until recently, where it's starting to skyrocket. And along with the number of homeless families that we're seeing, or with the number of homeless families, come many more homeless children. And the school systems in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth track that. And with the most recent data on homeless school children, it had gone over, for Minneapolis, 6%. So now we're reaching the period for the average classroom, you almost have two homeless children per classroom as a level reached in Minneapolis, which, of course, isn't a statistic that we want to see, anyone here would want to see. So that's the last slide. So again, this is what our website looks like, and with some Duluth information. So we have the statewide information, and as well as these various indicators of housing affordability for the four metro areas. In conclusion, I'll say that I just think in the long run, we really need to be thinking about how we can expand rental opportunities, and particularly where it exists, in that most of the affordable rental really is in Minneapolis and the first ring suburbs, and we need to be able to have these opportunities throughout the metro area and other parts of the state. And also in terms of that there are still some areas of the state who are very much dependent upon getting additional housing to help their economic growth, particularly companies in the food industry. So those are some longer term issues that I hope this committee gets at. But for the immediate, and looking at some of the data I've provided, I think there needs to be a focus in three areas. One is with addressing the devastation of foreclosures in some areas of the state where the foreclosures have been very concentrated and are impacting the viability of those communities. The second one is the need to ensure that we address what's going on with the rapidly increasing homelessness, is to really focus in on what it, to keep people into some stable shelter for the sake of their children and just the sake of our communities. And then third is that as the state looks at how do we get this economy going again and what type of investments do we need to make so that people can be put back to work, I hope that the committee looks carefully at the number of jobs that are produced through an investment in housing. One thing that investment in housing does, public investment, it leverages other types of private investment, so you get many more jobs created or sustained than you might with some other types of equally worthy public uses of funds. So I do think that the housing needs to be thought of as you think about stimulating the state's economy. And of course, as the chairman has been rightfully concerned about, is there's a great need to improve the health and safety and energy efficiency of the housing across the state. And that could be a good job generator, too, to get people to work doing that. So with that, I'll conclude.
Thank you so much. A couple questions here. Look like from Representative Scott and Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question. You were talking about Section 8, and you stated I guess I just want some clarification. You stated that Section 8 only makes available 30 units a month.
Thank you for allowing me to clear that, Madam Chair, Representative. There's more than a dozen jurisdictions across the state that administer the federal rent subsidy program. And what I was using was the example of the Minneapolis's program, in that all of these jurisdictions from time to time open up their waiting list, in that there's much more demand for these federal rent subsidies, where you pay basically 30% of your income for housing, for rental housing, than there is resources made available by the federal government. So they only open up their waiting list every once in a while. So when they opened up the list most recently this past summer in Minneapolis, you had some 14,000 individuals or representatives of households seeking applications for that. But the Section 8 resource has grown very little over the past decade or so, so that the resource is made available only as people turn in their Section 8 certificate and basically move on to other, move out of state or purchase a home, whatever it is that gets them out of the program. So they are only in Minneapolis able to recycle 30 of those Section 8 certificates in a given month. So that's what I was trying to convey. And just on that is, so again, the home line speaker can get into more detail, but on average you're seeing, or with many of these communities, it becomes from the if point you're interested in it, so many years till the waiting list opens up, and then once you're on the waiting list, so many more years till your name comes to the top of the waiting list, that it's, in many of these jurisdictions, it's 10 years time from, like, if you were just going to hope to apply in Minneapolis, from the time that you would actually get an apartment.
Yes, I just have a follow-up question, Madam Speaker, if I may. And isn't there a certain period of time, a limit to the amount of time a person can be receiving Section 8?
Madam Chair, Representative, there isn't a limit on that. It has been discussed at various times with the looking at federal legislation. But basically, the purpose of the Section 8 program is to say that there are many occupations, well, as we saw in the earlier bar charts, there are many occupations that don't pay enough to pay for an apartment. So you could be working your life at those occupations and not be able to afford it. So that's why Section 8 doesn't have a time limit on it. It reflects and realizes, or Congress did in setting up the program, that for many households, that they're going to be in a position for a number of years, maybe forever, that they could be working and producing in the community but not be able to afford housing. So this makes sure that they do have that level of affordability provided by the Section 8 certificate.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Albeck, I appreciate your presentation here. One of the slides I wanted to address, I got a couple questions here. One of them was the foreclosure, and you saw the disproportionately large amount that's in the metro area.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you track how many of those are a result of the lessening in the stringent standards in terms of when you get a normal loan, that you've got the formula is basically a third of your income, you go in with that, and then there's a percentage that goes down. We know that in the lessening of those standards, and particularly for affordable housing, to get people into housing, we took those standards away also to increase the number of home owners, so that there were people that got in with no down, with an increased percentage. Do you track any of those?
Madam Chair, Representative, there's a representative from the Foreclosure Prevention Council that can get into more detail on that. I do know from the counseling agencies, the report from the counseling agencies, that as of the last report I saw, the people who are in trouble on ownership in meeting mortgage payments are still folks that lose income, have a divorce, have a health problem that requires, you know, rerouting of income to pay that. There are, of course, 20,000, I forget the exact number, of those subprime loans that, you know, jump up in payment or adjustable rate that get people in trouble. So I don't want to diminish the importance of that, and those have been focused also in various markets. But at least as the last data I've seen on people seeking help through foreclosure prevention counselors, it's still the traditional ways that people have divorced, health costs, loss of income that get people into trouble. And we're seeing more of that now as health care costs climb, income decline, and a lot of stress on households. But I would suggest that you pick up on that question with the subsequent speaker.
We are going to have quite a bit of discussion on that. We have two people who will be presenting on that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a follow-on, and it may be for the follow-on speaker on this, but I think there's an easy tag on this, and that is for those individuals that did not make a down payment on a house, to determine what percentage of these loans that are being defaulted on are accountable to that. And so if you are the follow-on speaker, you can get back to me on that. I'd appreciate that. One of the other issues I wanted to ask you also is on this, on the rental Section 8.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the Section 8 provides, does that affect the market value of the rental market value in an area?
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. Over the years, there's been a number of studies on that because there has been concern that the federal rent subsidies are driving the market. And the studies I'm aware of basically say that there's not enough of that subsidy out there to impact the market as a whole. There could be very small sub-market pockets or individual building types that might be impacted by the availability of Section 8. But broadly across the rental housing market or for the Twin Cities as a whole, that there just isn't enough of the Section 8 subsidy to impact that market. It's far less than 10% of the available rental housing.
And just follow up, Madam. Sure.
Okay. I want to remind people we are going to hear from renters and too, so I think your question is very good. I want to make sure that we get a chance to get to the other presentations. Is it something else?
Yeah, just a closing comment here. An example for you from outstate Minnesota, up in the Staples area, where there is Section 8 housing and competitive market rate housing. The one at the market rate is about $100 below the Section 8 housing. The Section 8 housing is full. The market rate is about 70% full. Not much of a chance, as long as that the Section 8 is there, of the market rate being able to get filled because of the advantage that the funded housing has. So I think that would be very interesting for this committee to take a look at some of those market forces that are being driven out there, which are really putting a bite on the private sector because of these subsidies. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. We have two more questions, and then we're going to move on so we can try to get through all the presentations. There's just really good questions and a lot of good information that would come forward. So Representative Hayden and then Saylor.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Harper, how are you today?
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Well,
thank you for your presentation. I appreciate it. I think there is ample time to really talk about the kind of Section 8 issue. I think I have like one question and a comment about that specifically. One is, it's my understanding that over the last 10 years, we have not gotten any new Section 8 funding throughout the country. Is that right? As a matter of fact, we might have decreased the amount?
Madam Chair, Representative, effectively, yes. There have, from year to year, there have been very small additions of numbers of Section 8 in the thousands for particular uses, such as for veterans. But compared to the, I believe it's about 2 million units across the country, it really hasn't amounted to anything.
And then the follow-up question to that, and I don't want to get too far into the, the regulations of it, but there is some provisions in Section 8 housing that talk about rent reasonableness, in that if you are providing a voucher for someone, it should be competitive to what the market rate should be. Is that right? Would that be right?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, and there are regular market studies that are done by the federal government to ensure that the Section 8 is for a basic standard unit in a given market. And there are, of course, running a national program, you're going to find some cases where they don't, you know, exactly match the market, but certainly that is a role and function of the federal government in administering the program, is to ensure that the rents that are allowed through the Section 8 program are in line with the market.
And then one more question, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Just on the foreclosure rates, I think, along with Representative Stevenson, I think one of the things that I'd like to know is not only the zero down question, but also the deregulation of, say, no docs, that, you know, people were able to kind of state their income without being able to show that to the underwriter, if you will. So as we look at that issue, and I know we're going to get into that more, I think that's one of the questions that I really want to know, is not only the kind of, zero interest, you know, low interest, negative amortization, all of those things that have happened, but also just the kind of deregulation of people being able to show what they truly made, and the predatory nature of brokers pushing that market.
Okay, why don't we hold on to that question? It is going to be one of the foreclosure discussion items, I can guarantee you. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Halbach, I just have a simple question. You can get back to me about this, but referring to your slide about households spending at least half of their income on housing, I would like to know if that's broken down by county, and if so, I would like to get the information from my county so that we can discuss that later. Thank you.
Great. And that's a very good request to get to this organization, because they do track all of that, if I'm not mistaken. So thank you. Okay, we're going to move on.
Thank you.
As we go through these,
Madam Chair, it's not even a question to Mr. Hayes, it's just a comment, and to Mr. Malbach. It's in response to Representative Hayden's comment, and I understand that there may be regulations in place that are supposed to make sure that the markets ain't working. I mean, I know personal experience. I know this guy personally that owns some of this apartment issue up and outstate, and this is something that has developed in the outstate area. And how they go about getting justification for this is a great question of maybe we want to address as a committee, but currently that's not happening. That the regulation may be there, but it's not being followed if it is there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Two people who are going to speak with us on homelessness, Mike Davey and Patrick Wood, come on up to the podium here. After that, we are going to hear from three people who are going to address the vendor issues, so they can think about coming down. Welcome to the committee. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Good morning. My name is Patrick Gardenwood. I'm the state policy advocate for the Minnesota Coalition. Thank you for inviting us. In 2007, members of this committee were champions for people who were experiencing homelessness. It is wonderful work.
Can you speak up just a little bit? Maybe that microphone needs to be adjusted a bit, I think.
Oh, let me just...
There we go.
In 2007, members of this committee were champions for people who were experiencing homelessness. And we saw homelessness begin to plateau at historically high levels. We began to see homelessness plateau. We began to see results from some of the initiatives that this committee and others created. And then the housing bubble popped, and the economy went south, and more people are experiencing homelessness. More families, more children. Mr. Halbach referenced 6% increase in homeless children in the Minneapolis school system. That's close to a 20% increase over 2007. That's not okay. And we're going to ask you to be champions again. We're going to ask you for your help again for folks, for our fellow citizens who are experiencing homelessness. Because today, too many people in Minnesota, too many of our fellow citizens are calling something like this home. Mm. That's an insult to all of us.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Davey. I'm a community organizer, attorney, and policy advocate with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. What does it say when thousands of people in Minnesota have had to reduce their life's possessions to that which they can carry in a backpack? We should be outraged to know that there might be a family in Minnetonka, Sauk Rapids, or Minneapolis that might spend tonight experiencing homelessness. I think we should be outraged that there might be a veteran in Hastings or White Bear Lake that might experience homelessness tonight. And I think we should be outraged that there might be a vulnerable youth in need in Sauk Rapids or Walker that might experience homelessness tonight. I think it's a shame that there are thousands that will experience homelessness tonight in Minnesota, and especially since we know that we can end homelessness.
A lot of you have seen people carrying these kinds of backpacks around, and I don't know how many of you know what's in them. I spent about 25, 30 years working on the streets with people who are homeless, with mental health issues, chemical dependency issues. I've been outside living under bridges for a long time, and I kind of know what's in these backpacks. So let's take a look. Promise you no dirty laundry. Okay, what we have here, order for protection. When the economy goes south, a lot of relationships go south. And what we're seeing right now is an increase in the number of people who are utilizing domestic violence shelters. That's a population we don't always think about when we think about people who are homeless. And one of the things that's happening to people who are homeless, who are utilizing domestic violence shelters, is that it's taking them longer to leave because there's no place for them to go. Our domestic violence shelters, like all of our other shelters, are full. This is not okay. Mike, what else is in there?
It's a directory of services. Perhaps not unlike a directory of services that a homeless youth might consult tonight. But sadly, that homeless teen who consults this very directory is going to find limited support. Now, we're incredibly thankful, and I know that there are a number of homeless youth that are incredibly thankful for what this committee did in 2007, approving an additional $1 million for homeless youth programs. But we know that that's not enough. We know that there was an $8 million request. Mm-hmm. And we know that shelter providers report that in recent years, there have actually been losses in shelter capacity for unaccompanied youth, resulting in an increase in the number of youth turned away. And as Patrick had mentioned, and I believe Mr. Halbach had mentioned, while the numbers of homeless individuals did plateau, the fact is that for unaccompanied youth experiencing homelessness, their numbers actually have increased since 2003. And sadly, as a youth tries to consult this directory seeking help, we know that according to the Wilder Research Center, on any given night, there are between 550 and 650 youth that will under the age of 18 who will experience homelessness tonight alone. Over half have been physically abused or sexually abused. Over half have some type of mental health problem. Tonight, sadly, many will seek help, and some of them will not find it.
These are the folks that I know best. These are the kind of scruffy-looking guys, gray hair and beard, who live under bridges. Look a little bit like me. And all of them carry one of these. And it's a wallet. It's a little beat up. There's usually no money in it. But there are tons and tons of cards. I mean, like, okay, here's my state ID, and it's expired, and I can't afford to replace it. Makes it hard to get a job. My bus card, it's got 50 cents left on it. Bus ride in this town is $1.75. I'm not going anywhere. Okay, I had a job with my medical card before the COBRA ran out. So I talked to some social workers, and I have to apply for benefits. I've got to go see these doctors at these clinics, and I don't know how I'm going to get there. And okay, this is my Veterans Affairs outreach worker. You know, about 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 men who live under bridges are veterans. Okay, I got to get in touch with this woman. She's going to get my tribal ID for me, because folks who live under bridges are like homeless people in general, disproportionately people of color. Native Americans, 11%, approximately 1% of our population. Let's see here. Okay, this is from St. Stephen's. Let's see, they were full the last time I went there. Here's a guy who's going to get me an apartment if we can get some ID and stuff, but I don't know. And Harbor Light, well, they're full all the time. And Simpson Shelter, great shelter, but they're full. And I talked to this guy, and he used to be an outreach worker or something, and I don't know where to find him. Well, this guy, I met this guy at the Listening House. He was organizing people who were homeless, and I missed the last two meetings, and this is a reporter who wanted to talk to me about being under a bridge. And oh, I don't know, these people from this ACT team, they came to see me, but I don't have enough stuff to get anything with them. And then I've got job leads from Goodwill, and this place out here is hiring, but I can't get there because I don't have any money. And oh, and this is, yeah, my probation officer. That's kind of a snapshot of what folks under the bridge look like. That's a challenge for all of us. But nobody in this state, nobody in this country should be living under a bridge. No community is improved by having people living under its bridges. And these kinds of barriers can be overcome.
For many of us, an elementary school report card actually is something that might be, you know, something that's kind of hopeful. You know, we open it up and we're able to kind of track and see the progress. We're able to see how our children are learning, and we're able to help them with things that they might be struggling with. But sadly, for a homeless parent, a report card like this reveals that homelessness harms a children's physical health and interferes with their development. According to the Family Housing Fund, when compared to children with homes, homeless children have 2 times the rate of respiratory infections, 2 times the rate of tuberculosis, 6 times the risk of stunted growth, and 7 times the risk of anemia. Homelessness also impacts a child's ability to learn. Homeless children have 4 times the rate of developmental delay, 2 times the rate of learning disabilities, and 3 times the rate of emotional and behavioral problems. And unfortunately, families represent one of the fastest growing segments of those who are experiencing homelessness. And children in families, just the children alone, they represent 35% of those who experience homelessness here in Minnesota. Just over one-third, 35%. Just the children in the family.
Can you go back to this wallet for a minute? Because I just noticed something. It's a photograph of... that's me and my wife and my ex-wife in 1968. And that's my daughter. I picture from the early 80s when she was in college. We all have families. People who are under bridges, people who are in shelters, we all have families. Something people forget. You scratch the surface, you find a family. One of the things that we're seeing in our shelters is an increase in older adults, particularly older men, 55 and older. Young guys, I think, but older men who've worked hard, who've owned houses, who've been married, who've raised families. Why are these people living on a mat in a shelter? Why are these people who are veterans of the United States Armed Forces living in shelters and mats on the floor? Now, we can make all kinds of value judgments about these folks. The bottom line is, it's not okay. It's not okay.
It's not okay. And again, and just to conclude, in 2007, this committee demonstrated its resolve, and we want to thank the committee for all of its action to support a variety of solutions designed to bring us closer to ending homelessness. We know that these solutions will work. We know that together we can end homelessness. We know that together we will end homelessness. And I just think Patrick and I want to let you all know that you should expect that Patrick and I and others that are sitting in the audience today are certainly going to want to discuss with each of you in the coming weeks and months many of the solutions that this committee is already familiar with that will indeed bring us closer to ending homelessness. Now more than ever, we need to make sure that these solutions, that we continue to act on these solutions. Again, we look forward to a continuation of the great work that was started here in 2007. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And just so you know, this backpack is going to be donated to a street outreach program so that somebody will have a home.
President Lane, do you have a question? Just one moment, please. I just have a comment. I just heard a quote of a few days ago that stuck with me. Poverty is the enemy of the human being. So first and foremost, this is a moral problem, and then we look at the details, the administration, the how-tos. But first and foremost, we have to recognize that this is a moral problem. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we have three presenters who are coming down to talk with us about rental issues. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadleboy. I'm the Executive Director of HomeLine. HomeLine is a statewide tenant advocacy organization that operates two major programs. One is a statewide tenant hotline where anyone in the state can call in and ask questions about their legal rights. We've grown from serving just suburban Hennepin to the entire state outside the city of Minneapolis, which has its own state, or its own citywide service. I'm going to talk a little bit about the hotline first and then get into the stuff we've seen in the organizing and policy advocacy. I also want to let people know that sitting up here with me today is Michael Dahl, who will be joining us next week as our public policy director. Michael's been running the Homeless Coalition. Many of you know him as an advocate at the state. What we're really hoping we can do is integrate our state and our federal policy, give a good picture to the legislative leaders here, and also bring the concerns from the state up to the federal level. So we're really looking forward to having Michael on board. So I have a handout here. I don't know if there's someone who can... I've asked our tenant hotline director, the managing attorney, to identify the trends he's seen in the last few years. One of the things that's really unique about our service is when somebody calls in and asks a question about the renter's right, we track all that information. We keep track of that call, we see where it's coming from, and we can identify trends that we're seeing. Last year we took over 11,000 calls from around the state, so you really get a good picture of what's going on. What you're seeing here is Mike has identified in the last few years the trends in calls is really, really increasing in the foreclosure area. We hear a lot about homeowners, and we're going to hear about that in a few minutes. What's really, we're seeing the impact is renters who have done nothing wrong. They're paying their rent. They suddenly come home one day, and the three biggest things we're seeing with renters is they're the ones that get served a notice, the sheriff's notice, that says, hey, this is going to get foreclosed. They don't know what to do. They panic. A lot of these folks have kids in school. They want to be able to finish the school year at least. We see it also manifest itself in repair problems. There's a repair. Nobody's coming to fix it. Or there's unpaid bills. How do they get these bills paid? What it was the responsibility of the landlord and the lease? And lastly, what we see is security deposits. Real difficult time for those folks to obtain those security deposits afterwards. Just to give you a scale, I'm not going to repeat everything in this sheet, but to give you a sense about what we're seeing. In 2005, 1/3 of 1% of our phone calls were renters who were experiencing foreclosure and were asking questions about it. Now it's nearly 10% of our calls, well over 1,000 calls last year. So this is a significant problem, and I want to make the legislative committee aware that we're going to be coming in with some legislation to try to beef up all of these areas, and it's something we can get into details later, but know that it's an issue and we need to at least have the discussion about is there a way to protect the people who haven't done anything wrong. Also try to keep these homes from becoming vacant when there's good, responsible renters who want to stay in them. A lot of the banks don't know what to do with these folks and end up vacating the house and sitting there empty, and you've got a problem with vandalism, people coming in and taking over the house and wrecking it, when it could be getting rented and providing homes for folks. This kind of leads into the next section of what we're going to talk about. I spent 14 years as an organizer at Homeline working with renters in federally subsidized housing that's privately owned that was in danger of being lost. The big issue we're seeing, and I'll also tell you this anecdotally, every year when I first started, my boss, he said, one thing you should realize, this is the worst it's ever been for low-income people. Unfortunately, for 16 years, I've been able to say that every single year. I'm staying optimistic because I still think there's a way we can turn the tide, but know that before we hit this economic downturn, that's been a reality for the people who are at the lowest income. That's the seniors, the disabled, and the working poor. 97% of the people who call our hotline and that we organize are the working poor, the very low income, seniors, the disabled. So that's the people we're talking about when I talk about affordable housing. One of the things that I wanted to touch on was, when we look at the affordable housing problem, one of the things that we've done is, we talked about the Section 8 program a little earlier. There's two ways it's administered, and one of them is a voucher program where tenants wait to get a voucher and then take that to a private market landlord who's willing to accept it. They still pay 30% of their income. And one of the things that we found when I first started was, how hard is it for a tenant to use that? So we've been doing a survey for the last 15 years, mostly in the western suburbs, that's where we started, but now includes Anoka and Dakota County. And what it shows is that right now, when we did our last survey, only 1/4 of the private market landlords are willing to accept Section 8. So the thing to take a look at is, even when people get these subsidies, they still have to find a place to use it. But more disturbingly is the trend recently of the people who need it. We've started tracking, looking at the housing authorities and asking, how long does it take for you to open the waiting list, to get on the waiting list? And we also have asked them, once you're on the waiting list, how long does it take you to get to the top? And what we found in this last year is that the average wait in the metro area is 7 years between those two things. That's the average. It goes a lot higher. And when you think of the people who use Section 8, the one consistent statistic that you can see is the average use when somebody gets that Section 8 is 2.5 years. So the people who need it, they need it for an emergency. It's a situation where it's a medical or it's a divorce, it's a family situation where they need that help right away. So if we're talking 7-year waiting list to get that subsidy, it's just not meeting any kind of need whatsoever. And that's the reality. We have data for the housing authorities around the state if you're curious about your own district, how long people have to wait. So bringing that all back into the affordability being a problem for renters, one thing that we're very concerned about, and I know this will be dealt with in the tax committee, but as the housing committee members, I want you to understand that the renter's credit is a huge, huge resource for the people that we work with. And that's the people, like I said, that are working poor, the seniors and disabled. That is a targeted tax break based on your paying your property taxes as a renter. And we're very concerned that that stay in place. People get those renter's credit checks in August, and they spend that money immediately. That is money that is needed, and I've organized people for a long time. The seniors use that to pay for really basic needs. The young families that get it, they use that to send their kids back to school. I mean, these are, it's a real basic economic engine for these folks, and it's really important that when that renter's credit gets discussed this year, that you know that that is a huge resource, and it's something that goes right back into the economy where it's located. So just wanted to touch on that issue. And then I wanted to turn it over to Michael and talk a little bit about the resources we can use.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl, and right now I don't have a home organizationally. I'm working at the coalition. Right now I'm going to be transitioning over to Homeline, and I hope to work on many of the issues that Beth had a chance to talk about. Today is about studying the problem, so you get a sense of what it is you need to do. And you need to turn it from admiring the problem, knowing the facts, to actually doing something. That's what this committee's job is. And we're going to become friends to a lot of you, or we already are, because you really fight for us in ways that we appreciate. But too often, this committee is not given the resources it needs to actually address the problem. And so in 2007, it was the members of this committee that went to leadership on both sides and said, we need more money to actually address this problem. And we hope that you'll do that again if you're not given the right resources. Now, many, many years ago, I think in 2000, when the economy was doing all right and there were people who had more jobs and making more money, we asked for 1% for housing. Right now, the state allocates less than 0.3% for housing. Now, the economy is going in the tank because of housing. And if this committee is getting something that's just nowhere near the scale of the problem, I mean, what is to be done? This sheet of paper, this is the state budget, this is what you get. This is what you get, and it is the problem that is plaguing the state and the nation. So we hope that there is adequate resources, or better, more resources that come to this committee to address the problem. Now, you may be able to do that by going to leadership and say, of the existing pot, please give us more, because this needs to be a priority. And we'll be with you there to make that case. But it may take additional resources. And so many of you have been a part of what's been called the Work for the Housing Solutions Act. And it's designated resources. We have a designated resource. We're happy to talk about that. But the important thing is more money for a particular purpose. And we need more money for rental assistance. 42% of what we would get through the Housing Solutions Act would be used to increase rental assistance for people who need it. 33% of the resources would be used to develop and maintain workforce housing. People who need jobs and want to find an employer who also wants housing for their employees, we put the money into programs like that. And then also a local incentive fund. So that governments who want to put up money to build housing in their community or repair housing in their community or rehab the public housing that already exists in the community can get a state match wherever you are in the state. It does take additional resources, and that's why we've come up with a dedicated source. But what is important is that we increase what is available for this community to spend on the biggest problem the state is facing right now. Thank you.
Actually, Ron Elwood is going to talk about some other issues affecting renters. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Elwood, staff attorney with Legal Services Advocacy Project. We represent legal aid and, most importantly, low-income Minnesotans throughout the state. First off, I'd like to publicly thank the chair for her leadership on the housing policy work group that she and Senator Moi established this summer and has been working steadily throughout the fall to tackle some of these issues, both on the funding side and the policy side. And they've done an amazing job in pulling people together and getting people to generate ideas and for your consideration. And I'm just going to talk about a couple of them. I thought this would be helpful, though, a little background from last year for the new legislators who just didn't have the opportunity to participate in the debate last year, maybe watched it, but didn't participate, and for the returning members, a refresher on what you actually did very positively for renters last session. There was a similar work group that Representative Clark is running this year. Representative Mullery chiefed it last year, and out of that process came a whole series of proposals to assist renters in foreclosure, because as we all know, there are many problems that they face, not of their own making, but kind of, in this case, really the innocent victims of a foreclosure. So among the things that you did last year was make it easier for renters to keep their gas, electricity, and water going. There's an existing law, but you made it much more usable, and both for the renters and for the utility companies, to make sure that if the heat or light or water bill's not getting paid, that the renter can step in, pay the bill, and keep the heat on or get it back on. You also made it clearer for renters what their rights are in foreclosure by requiring a very plain language notice that goes out to the occupant of a dwelling when there is a foreclosure. Beth mentioned the fact that many people don't understand that they have the right to stay in their rental units until the end of the redemption period or the end of their lease, whichever comes first, and some people panic and just leave. And so this notice was intended to help people to say, don't panic, go get help, go seek legal aid advice or the homeownership center or home line, or let's tell you what your rights are and you don't have to panic and move tomorrow. There was also an extension of the notice at the end of the process when the foreclosure sale has taken place and the redemption period is done and it's over, the lender's taken the property. The renter at that point does have to leave, but there is a required notice that they get. They're told that, hey, you've got this amount of time and you're going to be out at the end of the month. Well, we extended that notice from 1 to 2 months to give people an opportunity to try to find new quarters to live in. And we also extended the right to get that notice to people who lease after the notice of the foreclosure sale was issued. A court decision with a strange outcome essentially segregated people who leased up before the notice of the foreclosure and after, and the people who leased after didn't get any notice that they had to leave. Well, that didn't make any sense. So you did a tremendous amount of work last year, and I applaud you for it. This year, some of the problems that have emerged, one thing we will bring before you is we need to fix that notice I just talked about regarding the notice to vacate. As for those of you who have been around for a while, you know that the best intentions sometimes get lost in the translation of the language that actually gets put into the statute, and we say something that we didn't actually mean, and that's essentially what happened, and we need a technical fix, a housekeeping fix, to make sure that what our intention was last year actually is expressed correctly in the statute. So that just shouldn't be any problem. It was non-controversial last year. This is just a technical fix. More substantively, however, we have identified some issues around contracts for deed and the lease with an option to transaction, otherwise known as, people call it, rent to own. Because of the problems that people now have obtaining credit and the glut of homes on the market and the problems people have selling homes, these types of transactions are becoming more and more prevalent. I know the city of Minneapolis in particular has been experiencing some issues around this. I know legal aid has been hearing about some problems. The nature of the transaction, what is it, what are people's rights? So we've been working with the Realtors Association, the Multi-Housing Association, the Bar Association, and other interested parties to try to come up with primarily what will be, I think, in the end, a very good plain language disclosure to tell people before they get into these deals, what are you getting into? Are you making sure that this is what you need? This is right for both parties? And so hopefully that should address some of the situations. That's all I have. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I look forward to speaking and working with you all throughout the session.
Great. Any comments or questions from committee members? Okay, thank you so much. Lots of good information. Moving right along to the foreclosure update part of this presentation today. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Housing Finance and Policy and Public Health Finance Division for the opportunity to address the committee today. I'm Cecile Bedore, and I'm the Director of Planning and Economic Development for the City of St. Paul, and I co-chair the Minnesota Housing, the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council with Warren Hansen, President of the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. Warren could not be with us today. With me here is Melissa Manderschein. She's an attorney with Kennedy and Gravens, and is staff to the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council. The Partners Council is Minnesota's coordinated approach to address our state's foreclosure crisis. The council includes representatives from city, state, and county governments, as well as nonprofits who serve the metro area, as well as outstate Minnesota. We work to coordinate all of our efforts to address the mortgage foreclosure crisis in the state, which are thoroughly described in the coordinated plan, and I think you all have a copy of this. Kind of details the primary focus of our work. Again, we work to identify, fund, and implement coordinated statewide policies and programs that effectively address the impact of the recent surge of mortgage foreclosures on our families, neighborhoods, and our broad communities. We are a national model, underwritten with the generous support of the local office of the Local Initiative Support Corporation, the Family Housing Fund, and the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. At least once a month, we get a non-Minnesota agency calls us wanting to know more about what we're doing here in Minnesota. Most recently, the partners participated in a call with an organization called Policy Link. Policy Link is using the coordinated work of the Partners Council as one of four national case studies. Chair Clark suggested an overview of the foreclosure crisis would be helpful and informative for all of members, so we're going to begin our presentation today with an overview of the issue in both Greater Minnesota and throughout the metro area. We'll then move on to discuss possible solutions. If your community has been spared from the recent foreclosure crisis, you should really count yourself as one of the lucky few throughout the country. Entire neighborhoods have really been devastated in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as Monticello, Faribault, Albertville, and other core communities such as Duluth and St. Cloud, which have also been heavily impacted. As many of my other colleagues have mentioned this morning, the base budget for Minnesota housing must be preserved as one of the solutions towards addressing this issue. The housing sector is critical to a healthy economy, as Mr. Halbeck noted, and we must all do what we can to stabilize the sector. The provision of and maintenance of quality, healthy housing touches on every aspect of our daily lives. It provides jobs, as we previously mentioned, prevents homelessness, lowers truancy in our schools, and stabilizes community, and so much more. We must also work to continue to fund our foreclosure prevention counseling. Counseling is far and away the most effective way to prevent foreclosures and stabilize our communities. Secondly, we must leverage the financial recovery dollars provided by the federal government through the HERA funds that came out recently. Our Minnesota communities are shovel ready and need your help. Other solutions include cost neutral policy changes that will go a long way in stabilizing our communities. Several organizations active within the Partners Council have drafted bill language and met with several stakeholders to reach consensus on some of these initiatives. We'll discuss these more in detail later in our presentation today, and we sincerely hope that a lot of these bills do get introduced. So moving on to identify the problem, the chart here is prepared by Housing Link, and it shows a dramatic increase in foreclosures from 2005 to 2008. As you can see, both Greater Minnesota and the Metro have experienced a dramatic increase in the number of foreclosures.
Nearly 28,000 were projected to occur in 2008, which we thought was an outrageous number and unfortunately showed to be accurate. This map is also prepared by Housing Link. It illustrates the rate of foreclosure in each county in Minnesota in 2005. This calculation was based on the number of households. The deeper colors you can see shows the greater impact. Now, if we compare this to 2008, you can see that the foreclosures have dramatically increased in just a short 3 years. Again, the darker colors, the more foreclosures as a percent of the total number of households. The entire state has obviously been impacted, with the greatest impacts being felt in the metro and collar counties, but also in areas near Duluth and St. Cloud. In some counties, more than 2% of the households have been foreclosed during 2008 alone. These photographs are just two examples of what the problem looks like in Greater Minnesota. Typically in Greater Minnesota, you'll have new subdivisions that have become ghost towns, properties never sold, as well as foreclosed homes that are obvious on the sidewalk due to boarded up and or deferred maintenance. Oftentimes, these foreclosures are clustered. For example, here's a map of foreclosures in Rochester in just 2007. As you can see, the foreclosures are concentrated within just a few blocks of each other. Because studies have indicated that each foreclosure results in a 1% drop in residential property values for surrounding homes, the impact of several foreclosures within a concentrated neighborhood really does have devastating effects. Here's another example. This map shows the distribution of foreclosures in Duluth in just 2 years. Most of these foreclosures are concentrated in the historic neighborhoods of Duluth. As in Greater Minnesota, vacant and foreclosed properties are a very serious and corrosive problem in the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. One of our challenges for our urban neighborhoods and city departments is that the foreclosed homes must be boarded in order to secure them. These same boards really announce to the neighborhood that there's disinvestment going on, there's nobody here watching the store, and it leads to continuing vandalism and neighborhood instability. We've experimented with several techniques to board these vacant buildings so it wouldn't look that way. We've used artistic board-ups, which are quite expensive, and other alternatives that are less costly, but still ultimately have not eliminated the vandalism and trespassing that we've experienced. The growth in the number of foreclosures in Hennepin County illustrates the scope and distribution of the problem in the metro area. The number of foreclosures have increased sevenfold in 5 years. Every community has experienced foreclosures, with communities such as Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis, and Richfield being especially hit. Here you can see the heavy concentration is in the northern tier of Hennepin County. In St. Paul, foreclosures have been generally concentrated in an arc north of the downtown in the past, but recently we see that foreclosures are now being spread evenly in every neighborhood. Even the most stable neighborhoods of Highland Park and other neighborhoods are experiencing this crisis now. Foreclosures, of course, account for an increase in vacancies. Unfortunately, there are many, many more vacant and deteriorated buildings in our city due to economic hardships. When the number of foreclosures and vacancies in St. Paul are combined, we expect that number to reach 4,000 in 2009. For example, we've got about 2,200 vacant properties in St. Paul as of September of 2008, and again, over 2,200 foreclosures in 2008. Maps really can't do justice to this crisis. It's really impossible to explain to you what the devastating impact is in our neighborhoods. For example, the property values in Dayton's Bluff, which is on the near east side of St. Paul, have dropped by as much as 16% from just 2007 to 2008. This impacts not only Dayton's Bluff, but the entire city, as our tax revenues are decreased across the board, and others are expected, or we ask, to pick up the slack so we can maintain our city services. The city and community organizations are working right now with Representative Clark's office to arrange a tour for some of you if you're interested to tour some of these hardest hit areas. I'm sure these maps give you an idea of how challenging this is, but I think when you see it with your own eyes and drive down block after block and see these vacant boarded buildings, you can understand why it's challenging for the folks who are still there and challenging for the city to find strategies to help keep those folks there, because they're the lifeline of keeping these neighborhoods going. As these slides have illustrated, foreclosures aren't concentrated in either Greater Minnesota. The problem has hit and will continue to impact nearly every region of Minnesota. It's not just metro, it's not just outstate, it's across the state. As bad as we thought the problem was so far, what we've seen is just the first wave, unfortunately. Some of you have may have seen the 60 Minutes program that aired in mid-December on foreclosures. Mr. Chilson is a prominent investment fund manager working with Amherst Securities and said, holy cow, things are going to be much worse than anyone anticipates. And I have to say, of working on this issue for the last 3 years, we kept saying, well, it's going to be bad in 2009, probably in 2009. Well, no, it's 2010. And now the number just keeps, the date keeps being pushed out. So we're not quite sure when this is actually going to end. This next slide explains, though, why this is going to happen. The orange bar you see here shows the wave of subprime loan foreclosures that we've just experienced. The next wave in yellow is just about to begin, and you can see the dramatic increase is projected. The blue arrow right between 08 and 09 shows where we are today, and as you can see, we are just on the cusp of resetting of the option arms and alt A's. The worst of it, again, won't hit until 2011. Mr. Tilson also predicted that 70% of homeowners with these option arm loans will default, and many will default during their teaser rate period, which is the rate at the beginning of the mortgage that's very low. This chart illustrates Minnesota's own reset future. The foreclosures of Minnesota's past 3 years have been of subprime loans primarily. As the previous chart and this one show, the next wave of foreclosures will be Alt-A loans. Alt-A loans are also known as near prime and are often option arms. These loans were typically made to borrowers who can afford a prime loan, but for some reason the borrower chose a non-prime product. For example, with an option arm, there's a period of time beginning where the homeowner pays less than a full mortgage payment each month, but after that period ends, the monthly mortgage payment jumps to the new monthly rate. Many borrowers selected an option arm assuming that they would be able to refinance their mortgage when the arms reset. Some borrowers may still be able to do so because they have the income and they have the equity in their mortgage. Oftentimes, though, there are a lot of borrowers who will not because they've lost value in their home, as evidenced by some of the things I've said previously. This chart reflects that phenomenon. The red bar represents the subprime loans. You can see the bulk of those have already reset. And by comparison, the blue line represents the resets of the Alt-A loans. The peak of our homeowners with Alt-A loans are scheduled to reset in 24 months going into 2011. The data backing up this chart shows alarming information. When one compares the two reporting periods from October 07 and August 07 for the two pools of loans, the data suggests that Alt-A loans now seem to be performing worse than they have before. In essence, more in foreclosure and more in real estate-owned mortgage companies. So again, the past foreclosures were subprime loans. The next wave, again, will be Alt-A loans. The shaded areas depict the zip codes with more than 25 Alt-A loans. Although concentrated in the metro, Alt-A loans obviously were used throughout the state of Minnesota. We continue to face an incredible challenge with mortgage foreclosures, but with your leadership, we feel that we can address this issue. I'm going to turn it over now to Melissa, who will take you through some of our suggested solutions.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. As Cecile mentioned, my name is Melissa Manderside, and I'm an attorney at Kennedy and Graven here on behalf of the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council. As we mentioned at the start of the presentation, Minnesota is a national model. We are doing things well, but we still have an enormous challenge ahead of us, especially in the next 2 years. In order to successfully address the thousands of foreclosures yet to come and the attendant vacancies, job and property value losses, and community deterioration, we ask you to maintain the MHFA base funding of $114 million. Housing is basic to our community, family, and state's economic stability. The question is simple. Can you imagine your neighborhood or district being in better shape at the end of this session without major foreclosure prevention and recovery investments from the state? We will detail more, we'll provide more details on the counseling recovery efforts in the following slides. The Minnesota Home Ownership Center has a network of 50 agencies that provide pre-purchase and foreclosure prevention counseling. Many of you are probably aware of the organization. They have, of the 50 agencies that they have, 23 offer foreclosure prevention counseling. During 2008, the center served 18,000 Minnesota households. Of those, 12,000 received foreclosure prevention counseling with a success rate of 50%. In addition to counseling, the center engaged in substantial education and outreach. During 2008. It included, among other things, 15 listserv email newsletters, and if you'd like to get on that listserv, let me know. 10 workshops with almost 1,000 people attending, 2 call-in sessions with nearly 150 folks participating, and 35 training sessions for professionals with more than 1,000 of those folks participating in those sessions. The center also co-brands its materials with local agencies, governments, and the like, and reaches hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans through things such as utility billing statements. Taken together, during 2008 alone, the center conducted outreach to more than 500,000 Minnesotans through nearly 100 different events and outlets. One of those particular outlets is this early notification option. The center has been successful due to commitments of the public, private, and philanthropic organizations. For example, the legislature last session passed a bill requiring that an early notification be sent to homeowners before the foreclosure process begins. This notice provides the homeowner with contact information for free, confidential, pre-foreclosure counseling offered through the agencies of the Minnesota Homeownership Center. If the homeowner doesn't contact the counseling agency, the agency contacts them. The notices were sent by the foreclosing attorneys, and since August of 2008, when the law went into effect, notification was sent to over 19,000 Minnesota households. Alerting homeowners is only half the battle. The center also needs the funding to support its statewide network of counseling professionals. To maintain its current levels of success and impact, the legislature must renew the HECAT funding for home ownership education and counseling in the amount of $1,730,000 for the base budget of 2010 and 2011. I thought a success story would be helpful. Here's an example from December of 2008. This was provided by the center, one of the counseling agencies affiliated with the Homeownership Center. This is an example of a particular homeowner who lives in Minnetonka. He's an 88-year-old widower. He relies on Social Security and a small VA pension for income. He was referred to CAPS, which is the partner agency of the center, through the pre-foreclosure notice that he received from his lender, the new type of notice that was created during last session. The homeowner refinanced in early 2007, and his payments were far too expensive for him to afford on his income. They were $3,000 a month. He had been trying to work with the lender independently, but had been unsuccessful. Through the help of a CAPS counselor, they were able to negotiate with the lender and ask that the lender recognize that the homeowner was on a fixed income and needed help in this situation. The lender offered a stipulated agreement and postponed the sheriff's sale. The lender asked that the homeowner make payments on time for 3 months, and if so, the lender would look at permanently lowering and fixing the interest and payments. So essentially, CAPS was able to work with the homeowner to get his payments cut in half. And they were also working with him on his household budget. Clearly a success story. Just one of thousands. The second thing we wanted to talk with you about is the recovery efforts that are necessary for our community stabilization throughout the state. As you know, Congress created the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, known as NSP, not Northern States Power, in July of 2008, and allocated $3.92 billion for the program as part of the Housing and Economic Redevelopment Act of 2008, also known as HERA, not the Great God. I just find these acronyms to be kind of amusing. So. This money provides assistance to assist neighborhoods, chiefly through acquiring and developing already foreclosed properties that might otherwise become abandoned and blighted. Minnesota will receive nearly $58 million, and Minnesota Housing will administer of that $38.8 million. In addition to the state awards, HUD made direct allocations to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Hennepin, Anoka, and Dakota counties. However, as the previous slides have made crystal clear, we need to leverage these federal dollars. Although these federal funds were certainly needed and will be put to use immediately, these funds are just a drop in the bucket. For example, of the $4.3 million in federal assistance that the city of St. Paul just received, it will only allow the city to impact 89 properties. When considering that the city anticipates that it will have nearly 4,000 vacant and foreclosed properties in 2009, the $4.3 million addresses 2.2% of the problem. Given the recent cuts to LGA and the magnitude of the crisis, as the previous slides have indicated, the city is proposing legislation through recovery to address recovery through policy and funding requests. I provided a handout
titled here, Summaries of Proposed Legislation. Here's a list of the various policy proposals that have been under discussion so far. Language has been drafted for each of them, and there are coordinators for each piece of legislation that have met with a variety of stakeholders and continue to seek feedback and encourage you to offer your feedback on these as well. Their contact information is listed on the handout. Several of the bills are near consensus, and some of them are consensus. Because our time here is limited today, we'll highlight just two of these bills, the Targeted Community Revitalization Program and the Renter and Contractor Deed language. The remainder are summarized in the handout. Ron Elwood, previous presenter, has already touched on the contract for deed legislation being proposed, and I thought he did a great job, and so I won't go into a lot of detail about that. But suffice to say that these changes are policy changes, and they're revenue neutral, and they can go a long way in protecting some of our state's most vulnerable purchasers and providing homes for families. And we also want to just make mention of the fact that we continue to work to develop new mortgage products. There's been so much time and effort put into the development of conceptual products that will help folks not only refinance, but also to purchase a home outright. And it's been very, very challenging. So if anyone has an interest or expertise in that area and would like to be involved in those efforts, please let us know. We're very interested in moving the ball forward in that area as well. With regards to the Targeted Community Revitalization Program, I wanted to highlight this. This is a policy proposal which is already in law, and it just requires some financial funding. So this program would be able to leverage the federal dollars that have been already provided to our state. This piece of legislation brings back to our communities a tool that was very successful at its inception back in the 1980s. It was created by this body during the last housing crisis, and the intent was to provide very specific targeted program dollars for our most devastated neighborhoods. The dollars were used for construction, reconstruction, alteration, and repair of buildings, energy assistance loans and grants, and the relocation or acquisition of real property. In short, the program allowed cities to do what they needed to do with the housing stock in their most distressed neighborhoods. At the time, the legislation provided funds to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and South St. Paul only. The statute, however, has not been funded for numerous years. The legislation that we put forward this year brings the program back to life. The bill will expand the authority to all cities in the state and change the name to URAP to reflect that. Change the name from URAP to Targeted Communities to reflect the statewide nature. The bill will also address the needs of foreclosed and vacant properties and will strengthen the opportunities around making homes healthier. The bill will require funding, just as many of the bills you've heard about today. This funding will be used to leverage the federal NSP funds, though, so it's absolutely essential that we build on the success that's already in place with the assistance of the federal government. Should you pursue a comprehensive housing recovery plan, the current targeted neighborhoods language that's already in statute is a great place to start. It is a proven successful vehicle that will allow cities to pursue all of the challenges that we've described here today. And it also complements and leverages the federal funding that the state has already received. If funded, this proposal will create construction and green jobs for our state's tradespersons. For your reference, the existing policy language is under 469.201. And this ends our presentation today. We'll obviously stand for questions.
Senator Scott, I think you had a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the panel there. I had a question backing up to the solutions/prevention counseling. You mentioned the success rate is more than 50%. I'm just wondering how you're measuring that success. I understand you have the one success story here, but certainly, you know, you aren't able to have any long-term data. I mean, maybe it's immediate success, but are these people going to be successful a year or 2 years down the road with what you've been able to offer? So how do you measure that success?
That success is measured in a very specific way. The Minnesota Homeownership Center tracks all of the counseling efforts that it has with individual homeowners, and they have a very scientific way of tracking that, and they arrive at that 50% number through that process. I don't have that specific methodology on my fingertips. I'd be happy to provide that information. But basically, it incorporates folks that have had their foreclosure prevented, as well as folks who are in
financial products that are not viable for them in the long term, and where the center, through their partner agencies, are able to resolve the financial problems that that family has and transition them into something that's more affordable for them. So success doesn't always mean that the foreclosure is prevented. Success can be more broadly defined as stabilizing the household. But I can get that specific methodology to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a slide, and I'd step out the room, so I didn't get a chance to look at it closely. On the mortgages that are set to reset because of the Alt-A loans, do you have a sense geographically in the state, or is there a geographic area where that might hit more than not? I know in my district, the subprime loans were really, really kind of, you know, they hit my neighborhood. Do we know geographically where the Alt-A loans may hit?
Yeah, if you look at the slide that's up here, this is what we have, the data that we have today. So while it is concentrated in the metro area, you can see that it's touched throughout the state as well.
Okay, members, this map here that we have, the shaded areas indicate zip codes where there is a presence of more than 25 Alt-A loans. And we know based on historic trends that a percentage of these loans will go into foreclosure. And if you use the percentage that was provided by Mr. Tilden on the 60 Minutes segment about a month ago, he indicated that 70% of these loans, these Alt-A loans, would go into foreclosure, that there'll be a default. And so the shaded areas on this map here, I shouldn't say shaded necessarily, but the cross-strike zip codes, those are areas that have these problematic Alt-A products.
Just one follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. The map is hard to read because it's so dense when you get into the metro area.
Oh.
Do we have a sense of, I can see greater Minnesota, but is that suburban, or is it going to hit Minneapolis and St. Paul in a big way? Do you, just even anecdotally, do you kind of know where those Alt-A loans are concentrated?
Chair members, off the top of my head, I don't have the zip code information of the specific zip codes that are heavily impacted, and I do agree with you. Unfortunately, this is quite dense here, but I'd be happy to provide a map that details the specific zip codes.
Thank you.
Mr. Mesmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Manderscheid, can you go back to the slide that was the 88-year-old person? I'm trying to understand, and I don't want you, if you're giving me information that you're not supposed to, don't give it to me, but do you know how much was the principal balance, how much was the value originally of the home or whatever, how long did the person live there? I'm trying to look, and do you know, are either one of you familiar with the case?
Senator?
Chair and members, I'm not aware of the specifics of this gentleman's situation. These are private counseling arrangements that they have, and when I asked for a story, they were able to provide me, after great hesitation, with some generalities, but they're not as inclined to provide specifics. But I could certainly ask them if they would be able to provide some more specifics with this particular gentleman, and with his consent, we'd be able to provide a great deal of specifics.
I don't want to get in. What my point here is, the things I would like to know is, where was this person's family, if there is one? How in the world did some bank give an 88-year-old living on Social Security a $3,000 a month loan? I mean, they're going to now negotiate it to $1,500. Surprise. I mean, I got an 86-year-old mother-in-law living on Social Security. I mean, she gets Social Security. She, thank God, has got a couple other pensions, too. But there's no bank doing that, or there shouldn't have been. I mean, there's got to be more to this. And that's some of the things I think we need to bring forward. If you can give to the chair some of the, and if, I don't even want you to have to ask this guy, because this guy shouldn't have to give out stuff. But if there's just a generality about, I'd sure like to know what in the world's going on, where we got people doing that kind of stuff. I mean, this poor guy shouldn't be signing papers for a $3,000 a month loan. You know, the bank, tough luck bank, give up $1,500 a month. You made this guy sign that? I mean, that's some of the stuff I think And they're not giving them a break putting it down. I'd like to know what the house is worth and how much he owed on it and stuff. I mean, somebody's ripping this guy off the way it looks to me. I wouldn't call it a success story that we fixed something that somebody should be in. I've got enough. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, you know, if you can get your hands on the 60-minute segment, and there's a 2020 segment also, I believe that same week or the week after, that really goes through really specifics with some homeowners of the banks doing exactly what we think is impossible for them to have done, which is essentially do this in terms of looking what their income is and what the value of their house is, et cetera. Because at that point, very few regulations on mortgage bankers, et cetera, and you make your buck by closing mortgages. So there was a lot of deregulation, and folks went out there and made a lot of money. And when this folks signed his name, great. So that's what we're trying to halt.
Okay. And to this point, and then Representative Lane. Just a quick comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm actually surprised that my fellow representative didn't realize that this is the problem. Lack of regulations and subprime loans, meaning they didn't have the money, subprime. And in the financial markets, investing and gambling at the stock market, this is the problem. Lack of regulation and lack of decency among human beings. Lack of integrity.
Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up to that. I spoke a little bit about the no documentation, and you spoke just a little bit, and I'm sorry, I'm really bad with names. I'm bad at looking at your name, so excuse me for pointing. Can you speak just a little bit about, theoretically, how this could have happened without, under a no documentation kind of deal? In other words, that they might not have looked at what his income was when they made this deal for the loan. That can you talk just a little bit about that, even if it's not about?
Chair members, could you restate your question?
Well, I guess my point, maybe I won't ask a question. I just know that there has been plenty of loans that were done in the subprime mortgage that did not look at people's incomes. They weren't required to. There wasn't an underwriting criteria. Or if it was that people just wrote anything down for their mortgage, or their mortgage broker might have encouraged them to say that you make a lot more than you make. So there wasn't any regulation to really stop that process.
Madam Chair, yeah. Members, I think that's correct. And I think also there were some folks who were given the teaser rates, and their loans were underwritten at that lower interest rate. Their loans were not underwritten at the adjusted rate. So they may be able to afford it at a 2% mortgage, but they're not going to afford it at an 8% mortgage. And just anecdotally, a personal story, when I went out to get my own mortgage, my mortgage broker told me that I qualified for probably three times what I thought I could. I had the wherewithal to know, no, I can't. But that person would have made a lot more money had he taken out a larger mortgage. So I think it depends on what the goal is behind getting that mortgage out the door.
Thank you. Ms. Anderson?
I think it would also be helpful to, at this point, highlight that in addition to providing foreclosure prevention counseling, the center also offers pre-purchase counseling. They have a great program called Home Stretch that provides a lot of sort of financial literacy training and similar sort of awareness that helps people make better decisions when they're considering whether or not they, one, can afford to buy a loan, and then two, how much can they afford to buy, or afford to buy a house, and then two, how much can they afford.
Chair, just as a final note, the City of St. Paul issues first mortgages to our first-time homebuyer program. I finally got it out. And our mortgage foreclosure rate is less than 1%, and I do think that is directly related to the amount of pre-purchase counseling that we do.
I have a question. I would call this kind of a repair after the problem. And so how much of the prevention counseling is actually negotiating to actually repair or recover the situation for the individual? Do you track that at all? Because when you were talking about the pre-counseling, that seems like that's really prevention, that's really, really important. How about in this instance, you're actually talking about someone who's been through, you know, pretty bad situation, and you help them fix it. So that negotiation, is that always a part of, I mean, is it quite often a part of your prevention counseling?
Chair and members, most of my understanding is that of the 15,000 or so households that the council, or that the center's partner agencies assisted during last year, 12,000 of those were foreclosure prevention counseling situations. And oftentimes, the mortgage support counselor acts as an intermediary between the homeowner and the mortgage servicer. So it's pretty common.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. Before you go, we do have two more witnesses for us today, and remember, we do have them until 12:30 today, meeting an extra half hour. A couple of things. There's been an offer to have a tour of the, and is this in St. Paul, Minneapolis, both? You're St. Paul, I guess you want to.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll we can do St. Paul, but we're happy to coordinate for both cities.
Okay.
That would be helpful.
I just want to find out if those of you who might be interested on that could communicate with Jake or with Blake. I think it would be good for us to, it would be good for us to get this set up. And I think the other thing is that you mentioned two videos or two documents that I think we could get as videos, 60 Minutes and 2020. So why don't we try to do that and have them available for the committee members too? So either connect with either of our staff here or to let us know that you're interested in these tours, and then we'll get back to you. And I think we can probably do it pretty soon because...
Okay.
Going to be getting real busy and running out of time, so I think the quicker committee members can contact our staff, that would be great, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, now we have two other witnesses. I know one will take a little bit more time, and the other one I think is kind of an announcement. So the next person coming before us is Suzanne Kiplinger. Welcome to the committee, and if you just want to introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Suzanne Kiplinger. I'm the Executive Director at the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis, and I'm here today to ask you to include in your discussion, when you're talking about homelessness, women and children who have been trafficked into prostitution. This is a group of homeless people that typically gets left out of the dialogue, and I think there's some very compelling reasons why their needs need to be addressed and included in these discussions. I did provide a handout, and it's pretty basic, and I'm happy to go into more detail if you'd like, but I know my time is limited. The first thing I want to say is that sex trafficking is prostitution. There's no real differentiation between those things. The state law and the federal law are in agreement about what defines the Commercial Sex Act as a crime. The average age of entry into prostitution is 12. So this is not a choice. This is not something that a 12-year-old girl wakes up one morning and says, my choice for a career is to be raped and brutalized by strangers every day. We also have statistics that tell us that 90% of women in prostitution want to get out, but they don't have the resources to get out, and one of the key resources that they lack is supportive housing, stable, supportive, culturally appropriate housing. So this is a key need in our community. We spend enormous amounts of dollars on law enforcement interventions, judicial system interventions, and social service interventions for women and children who have been commercially sexually exploited, trafficked into prostitution. We're not doing a good job of helping these women get out of this life because we're not providing the long-term supportive housing and the supportive services that they need. And so we continue to have this revolving door of arresting the women, putting them in jail, and then they get out and they have no place else to go, so they end up going back to their pimps or to the streets. We also know that disproportionately American Indian and African American girls and women are being victimized in this way. So one of the things that I'd like to point out is the lack of shelter beds. A lot of these women cannot get into domestic abuse shelters simply because the risk to other women in the shelters is too great. For example, if a woman leaving the adult correctional facility in Plymouth after having served time on a prostitution charge, she may have a pimp that is really eager to have her come back because she's his bread and butter. And allowing that woman into a battered woman's shelter oftentimes will heighten the risk to the other women and children in that shelter. So it's not always a good fit. It's difficult to find appropriate shelter for these women. The unique set of needs that they have is also a challenge. They have very high rates of trauma. Some studies tell us that women who've been prostituted have higher PTSD rates than war veterans. Mm-hmm. We also know they almost always have chemical dependency issues and mental health issues. They have multiple health care needs, and they have, most of them have been repeatedly victimized at the hands of predators. So they have a lot of needs that are not being met. I'll tell you two quick stories. My staff works with Native American women at the ACF in Plymouth who have been incarcerated on prostitution charges. They help them develop exit plans, we provide supportive counseling, and try to help them find ways to get out of that life. Recently, my sexual assault advocate was working with a group of 13 women, Native women at the ACF, on their exit plans. Of the 13, 11 needed housing. Mm-hmm. Of the 11, we couldn't find beds for 10, and so they went back to the streets or to their pimps. 2 weeks later, one of those young women, Violet Jackson, was found dead in an alley in northeast Minneapolis. She was 25 years old, and she left behind an 8-year-old son. She was trying to get out of that life. She had been initially victimized as a child, which is consistent with the patterns that we see about women who are incarcerated on prostitution charges. There's almost always early childhood sexual violence in their lives. She was one of those women, and she's dead because we couldn't find her a bed. To me, that's unacceptable. It's easy to make judgments about these women, and I'm going to really ask that we reframe that discussion and say that women who have been prostituted are victims of a system of sexual violence that somehow thinks it's okay for some of these children and women to be treated this way. The second story I'll tell you actually has to do with a housing discrimination case. It was a young Native woman who came to us. She thought she had a housing discrimination case. The situation was she's a single mom. She's in an apartment building, and her landlord wants to put her into prostitution. She says, no, I'm just not interested in that. And he's pressuring her. He's intimidating. He says, you sign this lease with me, or I'm going to throw you out. She doesn't want to sign the lease. He starts slapping her around. He posts her on Craigslist and starts pimping her out. She doesn't know where to go. She has no family. She has no other housing. So she comes to us and says, I think I have a problem with my landlord. Yeah. Mm. So we start looking into this and working with pro bono attorneys at Fagery and Benson that work with us. And we've now turned this case over to Minneapolis police because it came to light that this man was also preying on other young women in the apartment complex and driving around in a van that belonged to his wife's daycare. This is a housing discrimination case, but this is a common situation where young women who are vulnerable are being preyed upon by landlords, and they don't know their rights. So I bring this information to you. I ask for your consideration for this particular population. I'm happy to answer any questions. There's only few beds for this particular population in the metropolitan area, and zero, to my knowledge, in greater Minnesota. There's some resources in Duluth, but here in the Twin Cities, Breaking Free is the only program that I know that offers transitional and supportive housing to women trying to exit prostitution. The Pride program at Family and Children's Services also does a lot of good work, and we are trying to develop some additional housing resources for American Indian women in the Twin Cities because we feel that that will help them get out of this life. I thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? We'll be seeing some legislation on that in this committee, I can tell you that. Thank you very much, Ms. Kipler, for coming. The last person is Kathy Hying from A Day in the Life, and I believe this is coming to issue an invitation as well. Okay. Kathy here? Yeah, thank you. We do have minutes to approve from our last meeting, our very first meeting. Representative McNamara?
I'd be glad to move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative McNamara moves the minutes from the,
Kathy Hanworth, Western,
excuse me, just a moment.
Yes, ma'am.
Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted and approved. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Representative Clark. We're here from the St. Stephen's Human Rights Program. My name is Joshua Lang.
My name is Richard Johnson.
And we have some of our students who have participated in the A Day in the Life program. When I was listening to the last presenter, I actually realized that, you know, a lot of the issues that you're hearing about, it would be good to put a face to them. And so what our program does, the A Day in the Life program, is we take community members, we split up into groups of four, and we go out into the Twin Cities and see shelters, drop-in centers, transitional housing. The way we do it is have educators. We have 12 educators right now who have experienced homelessness, who have gone through the systems in the Twin Cities, and they're going to be your educators for the day. So the questions that you have in wanting to see what's happening in these shelters, what the housing first model means, to see that you'll go into someone's apartment. We have a guy named Seng who's one of our educators who will tell you about his experiences getting into housing through the state subsidized program and really kind of put that face to it. So Richard, one of our educators, will tell you a little bit more as well about how it works, but we want to open that invite for any of you to take part in it. So
with our Day in the Life program, and that's what we're here for, is we try to make make it a mantra that, if we say in a Christian term, to break bread with people, and then just to look at people in an egalitarian and a utilitarian. We try to bring out the best in our people, and that means our college students, as well as the people that are on the streets. So, because I think that the more you know about these people's stories and the endeavors and the trials and tribulations that they face as Americans, the more you hear that, the more you realize that you're very much closer to them in a lot of ways. And I think that I learn exponentially every time as a human rights organizer when we do these things. And so we'd like to be able to give that gift to you all who are working on housing issues, to see some of these extraordinary people that we're just lucky to be working with. I mean, there's just so much beauty in the stuff that they've been through. And I mean, we're right now working with the COLA program, and trying to help them get their voice out there to get a spot maybe for Native people that is just specific about their needs culturally, because they're going to shelters and they're not feeling like they're being appropriately addressed. And so we validate those voices, and hopefully, if you come and do our program with us, you'll be able to get that understanding in a real, real sense. Something that we can sit here and talk about 0.4%, and we can give you all these numbers up here, but if you don't apply those numbers and see how it's happening over here for this African American lady, for this Native American single man, for this Native mom who was a prostitute or whatever, if you don't see the outcome and the dynamics of these people, then you're not going to. I feel like it's the best. A lot of people have said that I've done social work for like 13 years. I've done, I've studied for 13 years, and this one day I learned so much exponentially. And I think that's what we want to do for you guys, Mr. Bly, and all you people that are out there, that you'll be able to see and break bread with people in however way you look at your Creator and how you see that. So, and it's a good day, and we'd love for you all to come and join and be a part of that.
Could you just explain, I asked these folks to come today because this is an invitation to committee members to spend a number of hours, and as I understand it can be kind of at the availability of the legislator to actually go with them into these situations where there's homelessness being experienced. It's a unique way. It's not the whole committee going as a whole, which we have sometimes done on a tour. This is a more individual kind of experience and opportunity. So could you just give a couple options for what you think would be available to a legislator here, and I'd ask Jake if he'll coordinate. If anyone is interested in participating in the Day in the Life program, you can contact Jake, and he will be coordinating with you. Can you just give a couple examples? What kind of time frames might be available to someone, a busy legislator, sure, who really doesn't want to do this?
What we try to do is cater the program to what the needs are of the people doing it. So as far as timing, if you want to come in for 3 or 4 hours, a half day, we can do that.
And we'll Saturday, a Sunday.
Yep.
Whenever it lines up with your guys' schedule. The thing is just to hear the stories from people, but really understand how cognitive these people are and how much, adversity. I mean, sometimes I go, God, as Americans, they're great people, man. I was homeless, and I grew up in East LA, and I'm Native, and I am Chicano, and I made it to the U of M, and, I am one of those stories as well. But I'm also an organizer. I'm also the organizer for this program. So it's good, and I think all of these kids, these guys here, have all gotten something out of it, and that's why they're here with us, to support us.
Do you want to say which colleges you're from? I think they'll be from the same. All from the College of St. Catherine?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're just going to see if maybe Melanie, you wanted to talk. She did the program last week, actually, and just she could say briefly what her experience was.
If I got time for one person to test, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity and the opportunity to talk to you. Before I did the Day in the Life program,
could you just say your name for the tape?
Oh yeah, I'm Melanie S. McGee, and I'm a senior in Family Consumer Nutritional Science at the College of St. Catherine, St. Paul. And before I did the Day in the Life program, I was very much into my life. I'm a very busy single mom, worked very hard in school, and homelessness, while a great concern of mine as a mother and a member of this community, wasn't something that was in my day-to-day life that I was intimate with. And after one afternoon spending with Rich and Josh and Terry and being able to actually go in and see the transitional housing and be a part for one day of a person's life who is homeless in my community was amazing and literally changed my life. I don't think that even me telling you will give you the sense of what you will receive, the benefit for you out of being with these people. It is truly an experience that if you haven't had and you're on a committee where you're deciding housing decisions for your constituents, then you need to be out there and see what they see and feel what they feel, and it will change how you think of this, how you relate to it. As they say, with our foreclosures and as many problems as we've been having, we're talking about women and prostitution, it's very hard to feel disconnected. It's very easy to feel disconnected. And this is a very easy, simple way to get into the heart of what you're trying to solve. And it's important. And as a registered voter, I want to know that the people who represent me are out there doing what they need to realize what the problems are and not safely from a distance. So I appreciate your time.
Any questions, Kevin? Okay, thank you all for your time. I really do appreciate you coming today. And again, be in touch with Jake. He's going to see if any of our legislators can work out a time with you. And this is an open invitation for, it's not a deadline when people need to apply. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, any other
thank you.
Questions or concerns from committee members? We are going to be hearing in our next hearing about some of the federal dollars, I believe, right?
Let's see. Our next hearing is from the bottom of your agenda of January 27th, and we're going to talk about the recent federal action. We hope to be more informed about what's going to be available from the federal stimulus package and other sources. And on the 28th, we'll be hearing the MHFA budget. The governor will have given us his budget proposals, I believe, the day before. And we'll know what those proposals are, and we'll begin our process. Just want to encourage any of you who have issues or ideas or want to get involved in any of the legislation that's been presented today, please come and talk with me and my staff, and we'll try to make sure that you have a chance to take some leadership. We need all of us to really work on these issues. So thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.